Okay, thank you everyone for coming this evening. I kind of want to begin straight away with what we might call a couple of trigger warnings. First and foremost, we're talking about the problem of evil. Essentially, the question of why do bad things happen to good people, a slightly more philosophical form of that question. Naturally, the Holocaust is going to come up. We're going to try and avoid talking about the Holocaust for as long as we possibly can. But at the end of the day, we're going to end up talking about it, and not just talking about it, but talking about several different rabbinic explanations as to why the Holocaust happened. And even though we will be, spoiler alert, critiquing those explanations, I just want people to be aware in advance that they are going to be, we're going to be talking about some, like, this is why the Holocaust happened. And if people find those sorts of things disturbing, I just want them to be forewarned in advance. Second, and this is also very important, there is a distinction between what we are going to be talking about tonight, and which is the philosophical problem of evil, which is a theological challenge we're about to see that essentially denies the existence of God. And that's a philosophical challenge. There is another version of the problem of evil, which can be called the personal problem of evil, which is when an individual or perhaps a group of people, a collective, experience evil, experience some sort of horror and tragedy, and they confront why this evil happened, and it's very difficult. And I'm going to talk more about the personal problem of evil at the end of the third class. But it's very important to draw a distinction between the two. When I previously gave this series in my past shul, I gave basically the same question, a slightly different version of the series. And one of the people who came, who attended, was from the wider Jewish community. I had never met him, but tragically, his daughter had died young. And even though he was not coming to find solutions to those problems, he'd become interested in this topic as a result of his experience. It's really important to recognize in advance, if you find these answers meaningful to you on a personal level, that is great, but they're not really designed to be. They are philosophical answers. And often when we confront the personal problem of evil, these answers are no help. In YU, I remember a professional grief counselor came to talk to us once to talk about how to help people process bad news. And he turned around and said, if people ask you, you know, how could this happen to me? That's not the time to start, you know, defending God. He can take care of himself. Now is not the time to start discussing all of these various theological answers to this problem. It's a very different beast entirely. So we are going to be focusing on a philosophical question. How can evil exist, or how can God allow evil to exist in this world? And the various solutions to it, if those answers have some meaning to you, great. But the goal of this series is not to process any personal, you know, challenges people may be confronting. And I just want to stress that at the very beginning, because we are going to be looking at a lot of this from a colder, more analytic lens. But with that, I want to straight away share the source sheet. And so you can all see. And I want to begin straight away with a very, very powerful source number one, which was actually the motivation for why I called this share when God silenced Moshe. And it's from the Gemara in Masechet Menachot. And it's a fascinating and somewhat well-known series of stories where Moshe Rabbeinu sees the greatness of Rabbi Akiva and a lot of different fascinating things that emerge from that. And then Moshe turns around and says to God, source number one, Amar lefan of Rabbono shel olam, haritanu Torah, you've shown me the greatness of his Torah. Harini schara, I want to see his reward for all of this great Torah. Amar lo chazola achoracha, go back. Moshe keeps on going back and forth to kind of visit Rabbi Akiva in a time machine, as it were. Chazola acharav, Moshe went back. Ra'ash shoklin besara b'makulin. They saw that they were weighing Rabbi Akiva's flesh in a butcher's shop. If you will remember from either Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur, Rabbi Akiva was one of the people who was brutally murdered by the Romans. Amar lefanav, Moshe responds, Ribono shel olam, zo Torah v'zo schora. This is the Torah and this is its reward. Amar lo, God responded, shtok, be silent. Kach ala b'machshava lefanai. This is what has come to me. This is my intent. This is my decree. First of all, the importance of this source that we also have to realize, it's a very powerful source. And God, Moshe wants to know the answer to why did bad things happen to Rabbi Akiva? And God says, shut up, you'll never understand it. But we also have to realize that this is a story authored by Chazal. They were aware of this problem. They were aware of the challenge of bad things happening to good people, of evil existing, and their response was a non-response, which we'll talk more about next week, but their response was to essentially say, we cannot understand, we cannot comprehend. However, despite the fact that Chazal seemingly, you know, at least in this Gemara in Menachot, didn't think there was an answer, it didn't stop them from offering alternative answers, and it didn't stop most Jews throughout Jewish history from offering different answers to the problem of evil. But what I want to first discuss is what exactly the problem of evil is from a philosophical perspective. So again, we're familiar with the question, why do bad things happen to good people? But to put slightly more philosophical rigor to it, it actually becomes an even greater challenge. So if you take a look at source number two, we have two statements that contradict one another. The first is that an omniscient, and yes, that is how I pronounce it. I'm not going to be pronouncing it. I'm going to be saying this word a lot over the next few weeks. I'm not pronouncing it wrong. This is how I pronounce it. An omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God exists. An all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good God exists. And I'm going to explain this problem in a second, but first to read the second statement. Evil or bad things exist that should be prevented by an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God. Therefore, an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God cannot exist. Let me explain what this challenge is. So we'll try and keep things light, at least to begin with. So we won't use something truly evil. We'll just use something bad. And I can actually use an example from today. Today, I was taking a call on my cell phone, and I was pacing around outside the shul after I hung up. Ruthie had texted me, so I was responding to the text, not really paying attention to where I was going, and I walked into one of the stone benches outside the shul. It hurt. We would not describe that as evil, but we would describe that as a bad thing, something that no one would want to happen. Now, hold on a second. We believe as an Ikar Emuna, as a fundamental of our faith, that God is omniscient. God is all-knowing. God has always known. For as long as God has been God, which is forever, God has always known that I would, this afternoon, whatever time it was, hit my leg on that stone bench. That is omniscience. He's omnipotent. He could have done something about it. Something effortless by definition. It would have been very easy for God to do something to make me avoid that bench. And he's omnibenevolent. He's all good. He does not want me to get hurt. That is something we would assume from an all good being. And yet, I nonetheless hit myself on that stone bench. I was hurt. It must be, therefore, that God, what we won't answer right now is it could be that God is not one of these three, but we're not going to talk about that right now. We're going to assume right now all of these three, omnipotence, omniscience, and omnibenevolence, are definitive features of God. And therefore, the fact that I hurt myself must mean that God does not exist. Because if he existed, he would have stopped it. And this is the problem of evil. The first two premises contradict one another, and we know evil exists. We experience it. We see bad things. We feel bad things. And therefore, it must be that the omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God does not exist. This is the problem of evil, is a theological refutation of the existence of God. God could not allow bad things to happen. Bad things do happen, therefore God cannot exist. Boom, there you go. What we are going to spend the next 3 weeks discussing are four different types of solutions to this problem. What we are going to focus on tonight are probably the best known response, which are sometimes called theodicies, which are going to challenge the second premise. The evil does indeed exist the way we think it does. Next week, we are going to talk about two fascinating responses, one of which is essentially the non-response, similar to source number one. We'll see source number one again next week, which denies the validity of the conclusion despite accepting the fact that the two premises are true. What we'll also talk about next week is what is sometimes called the non-traditional response, which calls into question what we mean when we say God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. And then finally, in the third week, we will talk about one of the most fascinating responses, which is called the free will defense, which is going to claim that, yes, P1 and P2 are correct, but there is a third premise that we are missing that allows God to exist in a world in which evil also does. Before we go any further, I just want to say that this is, for me, one of the most fascinating topics to ever talk about philosophically, and not just because the problem of evil in and of itself is a fascinating topic, but also because, as we'll see not so much tonight, but over the next 2 weeks, the problem of evil also gives us a whistle-stop tour of some of the other major philosophical issues in Jewish thought. So next week, we'll be trying to talk about what is omnipotence, what is omniscience. We'll be talking about free will in the final week. We'll be talking about a lot of different topics that are all fascinating as we seek to discover resolutions to the problem of evil. What I also like about this is we get to see some of the chokhmah of some of Judaism's greatest rabbis. We get to see some of the wisdom of all of the various different answers that have been suggested. And finally, personally, I am often bothered by the fact that people believe Judaism has an easy answer to this question. You will find in some rabbis, some Jews will profess that there is a very obvious and easy answer. And as we're going to see, that's not true. And I think it is a grave injustice when we pretend that there is a simple answer to this challenge, when Jews for hundreds, if not thousands of years, have struggled with it. And so, again, by spending 3 weeks on this topic, we're going to at least grasp just how complicated it is. I did just get a notification on Zoom that participants can see my application. So I just want to confirm everyone can see the screen and has been able to see the screen. Okay, great. Andy's thumbs up means his experience is the same for everyone else's. That's how this works. Okay. The first type of solution, and what we're going to talk about tonight, are sometimes called theodicies. And these suggest that what we saw in premise two, that evil or bad things exist. No. What you experience as evil is actually something else. The first type of solution, the first alternative to evil is it's actually justice. And this is, for good reason, one of the most popular answers ever offered. It is woven into the fabric. Reward and punishment are woven into the fabric of how we experience our Jewish lives. First and foremost, take a look at source number three. We say this every time we say the Shema. It's the second paragraph of the Shema. Hishamru lachem, penifta levavachem, besartem, va'avatem, Elohim acherim, v'shtachavitam lachem. Be careful not to be lured away and serve other gods and bow to them. V'chara af Adonai bachem, God's anger will flare up against you. V'atzar et hashemayim v'lo yichya matar. He'll shut up the skies so there'll be no rain. V'ha'adama lo titein et yivula. The ground will not yield its produce. V'avatem mehera me'al haaretz hatova asher Adonai notein lachem. And you will soon perish from the good land that God has given you. We say this in the second paragraph of the Shema. If we don't do what God says, we will be punished. We will suffer. Bad things will happen to us. The first explanation of the problem of evil, the first solution, is very simple. There is no such thing as evil. There is no such thing as bad things. There is only punishment. We see this. We don't even see this in the Shema. This is one of the most famous Gemarot ever, probably known. Why were the Batei HaMikdash, why were the temples destroyed? Source number four. Mikdash Rishon, the first Beit HaMikdash. Mibnei Macharav, why was it destroyed? Mibnei Shlosha Devarim Shahayubo, there were three sins that people committed. Avodah Zara, idolatry, Giloy Arayot, forbidden sexual relations, Ushvichut Damim, and bloodshed. Aval Mikdash Sheni, but what about the second Beit HaMikdash? Shahayu Oskin B'Torah Uv Mitzvot Ugmilut Chasadim. The generation there, they weren't bad like the generation of the first Beit HaMikdash. The generation of the second Beit HaMikdash, they learned Torah, they did mitzvot, they did chesed. Mipnei macharav, why was that destroyed? Mipnei shehaita bo sinat chinam, because of baseless hatred. The famous Gemara we always quote right before Tisha B'Av, were one of the furthest points from Tisha B'Av possible, but there you go. It's a very familiar idea. Why was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Why were the Jewish people exiled? Why did all of those people die? If you remember, if you might have tried it to flee from your mind, in Megillat Eicha, Lamentations, you know, people eating their own children, all of the horror, all of the just everything, all of that evil. Why did it happen? People were being punished. That's why. That it was a punishment. It's not that God, that there's any problem with God being unable to stop me walking into that stone bench, but I deserved it. There was some reason this afternoon that God felt it appropriate for me to, and it wasn't just because I wasn't paying attention. It wasn't punishment for not paying attention. It was something. Perhaps I'd forgotten to say a bracha. Perhaps I'd done some other, sin that meant that, boom, I was in a lot of pain and I hurt my legs. They're scratched up. It's not that bad. That is the first answer. And it is theodicy. The reason bad things happen is not because we actually see evil, but rather because God is just. There is a variant on this theme, which is also something we say every single Shabbat. Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbat, the psalm for Shabbat. What do we say in the middle of it? Ishba'a lo yeda, a brutish man cannot know, uchsil, an idiot. Lo yavin adzat, cannot understand this. Bifroch resha'im kmo esev, though the wicked, they sprout like grass. Vayatzitzu kol po'ale aven, that all evil blossoms forth. Lehishamadam adayad, it's only to be destroyed. That really the wicked succeed in order to set themselves up for failure. That what's happening is evil as we see it. And again, what source number five kind of reveals is goodness as we know it might not actually be what we think. Evil as we know it is not actually there in order to, it is not actually evil. Rather, it is simply justice. That is one axis. That is one avenue of exploration when it comes to resolving the problem of evil. Relatedly, is the Gemara in Masechet Kiddushin. Lama, source number six. Lama tzadikim nimshalim ba'olam hazeh. Why are the righteous, to what are the righteous compared to in this world? Which is, as we're going to see from the context, just to give the context, why do they suffer? Li'ilan, like a tree, shekulo omeid b'makom tohora, that is completely in a pure place. The nofa notel makom tuma, but it has one bow overhanging into a place of tuma, a place that's not spiritually clean, that's impure. Niktsats nofo, when the bow is chopped off, when you chop off that branch of the tree, kula omed bimkom tuma, all of a sudden, the entire tree is now once again in a place of cleanliness. Kach HaKadosh Baruch Hu mevi yisurim al tzadikim ba'olam hazeh. This is why God makes the righteous suffer in this world. Kedei sheyarshu ha'olam haba, that they may inherit the future world. This Gemara suggests that it's not that evil is justice, but evil's actually kindness. It's a reward. It's purifying. You actually want to suffer in this world. The righteous aren't being punished. They're actually being rewarded by suffering in this world. They will not suffer in the next world. Once again, we have this idea, evil does not actually exist. What you experience as evil is actually goodness. It's actually kindness. Why did I smack my legs into the bench earlier today? Because God loves me. Ah, I'm so fortunate. I am such a tzaddik. I am so, if only I was more righteous, if I davened my kavana, if I davened my shacharit this morning with even more kavana, I would have tripped and broken my nose. I wasn't so righteous. So I just scratched my knees. I just hurt myself slightly. Rav Soloveitchik has a very fascinating kind of take on this. And he's critical of this approach, but he says, source number 7, I believe that this is a very clear-cut and equivocal example of how the thematic halacha has handled evil. Don't need to get into right now what Rav Soloveitchik means by thematic versus topical halacha. That's a topic for another time. It is a radical approach, of course, simply disposing of it. Sometimes if a problem is too embarrassing and too tormenting, one simply puts it in the wastebasket and ignores it. What did Chazal do here in source number 6? They were so uncomfortable. They were so challenged by the problem of evil that they basically come up with this idea that, oh, it's actually a reward in some way. It's purifying. Something good is happening. If only you realized, if only you recognized what was really happening, you'd see it was actually good. This was a good thing. And this is, we have a few more sources to see, but this is, I'm going to scroll back up already to the problem of evil. Now you see why this is a solution to the problem of evil, philosophically speaking. Because the way the second premise works is evil or bad things exist that should be prevented by an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God. But what's actually happening according to Theodos is there's no evil. God is not unable to prevent something. It's the opposite. God is the cause of this act of justice. He's punishing you. Or alternatively, and even more extremely, God is not unable to prevent evil, but rather he's being kind to you. You don't realize it. You don't recognize it. And here is where, you know, the classic analogy, depending on kind of the religious circles you have kept, it's like amputation. Oh, if someone walked in on a doctor amputating a leg, they would be like, what are you doing? You're chopping off the leg. But if you actually realize the medical situation, you realize the amputation is important. The amputation is key. And this is, again, it's the doctor's actually being kind when he chops off someone's leg. So too, God is being kind when he lops off the bow, when he visits challenges upon people. Now, it has to be acknowledged before we go any further that this is probably the standard response to the problem of evil. Most people don't ask much more beyond it. And when they receive this answer, and again, I am somewhat shortchanging the answer in the sense that I've kind of been speaking about it the entire time in a somewhat mocking tone. But the truth is, you ask a lot of very serious, you know, Jews, why do bad things happen to good people? They are almost certainly going to give you some sort of answer based on sources 3, 4, 5, and 6. That is, it's the theodicy, it's the classic answer to the problem of evil. It's the classic resolution. And it is. It's undeniable that it's an ethic, an idea that's found within the Shema, that's found within the Gemara. We talk about these ideas the entire time. But there is, I'd imagine all of us feel that there is a problem with this idea. Because, fine, I hurt my legs earlier today. I was in pain. You know, if you have a headache, if you, you know, don't have a good night's sleep, if you drop your phone and break it, minor inconveniences, you can attribute it in some way to some sort of punishment. But what about when we start to get into the bigger and more obvious and more striking examples of evil. Then all of a sudden, things start to look a lot less clear. Take a look at source number 8. So this is from a different essay of Rav Soloveitchik. It's actually his famous Kol Dodi Dofek, his speech on Yom Ha'atzma'ut in the 1992 is the year it was printed, not the year it was delivered. It was delivered much earlier. To which Rav Soloveitchik discusses the problem of evil, and we'll talk more about his approach next week. But this paragraph is important for now. Evil is an undeniable fact. You can't just claim it's justice. There is evil. There is suffering. There are hellish torments in this world. Whoever wishes to delude himself by diverting his attention from the deep fissure in reality, by romanticizing human existence, is naught but a fool and a fantast. Rav Soloveitchik has no patience for the denial of evil. It is something we cannot do. And if you take a look at source number 9, Peter van Inwagen. Peter van Inwagen is not a Jew. He is a I don't know what he does nowadays. He's pretty old, but he is a professor of philosophy in Notre Dame. And he is a deeply religious Christian, and he's part of that school of religious philosophers, deeply Christian, deeply religious, analytical philosophers who obsess over these kinds of theological challenges in ways no one else does. And he has a book on the problem of evil, which is fantastic. And he points out, if we think of soldiers making mothers watch while they throw their babies in the air and catch them on the points of their bayonets, or of the ancient Mesopotamian practice of Moloch, of throwing living infants into a furnace as a sacrifice to Baal, we shall, I hope, find it impossible to say that evil is not real. Bad things really do happen. Anyone who, like Alexander Pope, says that we call certain things bad only because we don't see them from an eternal level is in grave error. We have to acknowledge, we cannot deny that evil exists. And we've gone about 30 minutes since my trigger warning. So at this point, we have to mention the Holocaust. Like, it is acceptable to say, I hurt my knees, perhaps as punishment. It's acceptable to say you broke your phone because of punishment. But to condemn 6 million Jews, 1.5 million of them children, to claim that terrorist attacks, tsunamis, all of these various natural disasters and human atrocities, to claim that all of them are not actually evil, but justice, but kindness, is a very discomforting claim to make. It's something while I acknowledge, again, look through Tanakh, how many times, you know, it's one of the famous examples in Sefer Yirmiyahu, the book of Jeremiah, that God refers to Nebuchadnezzar, the man who will destroy the first temple, as Avdi, my servant, which is usually a superlative, because again, even within Tanakh, God is, you know, God is punishing the people through this atrocity. We see it. It is a valid, technically correct response, but I would argue it's an awful response. To turn around and claim that all of these various atrocities are as a result of some sort of punishment is a really, really horrific thing to say. And the truth is, what makes it particularly difficult, what makes it particularly challenging, and what makes it particularly abhorrent is when you look at the explanations given, they are never some genuine flaw within the people. So if we, you know, you think back again, I'm just going to scroll up a second, source number 4. Why was the second temple destroyed? Sinat chinam, baseless hatred. I've ranted about this before, and I'll rant about it again for the next second or two. You know, we always think that this gives us an excuse to point at everyone else's baseless hatred towards us, but it's actually supposed to be a call for us to reflect on our own baseless hatred. What Chazal do is they acknowledge, they critique their own society. There was a genuine societal failing that led to this mass catastrophe. But how do rabbis tend to react to atrocities nowadays? How often have you seen a headline, Rabbi X said catastrophe Y happened because of a lack of chesed, because of a lack of self-reflection within the community. You know, this happened to, you know, the Haredi community because the Haredi community's failure is X. Never. That doesn't happen. Why did the Holocaust happen? The Satmarov says Zionism. Why did the Holocaust happen? Some religious Zionists say insufficient Zionism. Note how it's the cause celebre, and note how it's their opponents, those with whom they disagree, who are responsible. There is an infamous sefer called Oz V'Hadar Levusha, which is a book on the laws of tzniut, on the laws of modesty. Usually I give book recommendations. This is a book anti-recommendation. Don't read it. It's not worth it. It's in my yeshiva in Hakotel, we used to have a little thing where we would read sections of it as like intentionally for fun, as like a, do you want to read the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard? It was written by a rabbi in England. And the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard about this book is that someone in Manchester edited the book and took out the extreme bits. Given how extreme this book is, it makes you wonder what on earth was taken out. But the author blames a series of tragic deaths in the community on women wearing skirts with slits in them, revealing too much leg. Note, the author does not criticize men for looking in the wrong places, does not criticize a lack of chesed. He criticizes people with whom he disagrees for doing something he disagrees with. And that is the problem with theodicies. Not only do they make us uncomfortable, not only do they not stand, I want to stress, we have to acknowledge they are a legitimate answer of Jewish tradition, because to deny that is to deny the act of prophecy itself, because many prophets explain evil as punishment. But people these days aren't prophets. And not only is the answer of theodicies dissatisfying on an emotional level, but often the solutions that are given are usually actually polemics. They're not actually answers. Rabbi X said, I remember when a horrific hurricane hit New York and doing mass damage and catastrophe. And so one rabbi was like, oh, well, New York just recently legalized gay marriage. This must be why it happened. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, what gives you the right to say that? It was before Hurricane Sandy. Hurricane Sandy was New Jersey. This was in New York. I was in YU. Someone had messaged Hurricane Sandy, which is why I suddenly sounded like I was telepathically communicating with someone. I was actually in YU when this original thing hit, and because we were in the Heights, which is one of the highest points of New York City, YU was actually relatively unscathed, which was nice. But the problem with this response to evil is that it is too often a barely masked polemic about people they don't like. And I want to read with you now an absolutely incredible quote of Rav Lichtenstein. And it's a lengthy quote, but it perfectly captures everything I'm trying to say. So it's from it's a translation of an article in Vala magazine from 2011. The title, Rabbi Lichtenstein to Zionist Rabbis, Some Humility, Please. And it was Rav Lichtenstein being interviewed about mainly the disengagement from Gaza. So the italics, which, you know, you see are the interviewer's questions, and then I'm going to read his actual, you know, answers. So the interviewer asks, unlike many Zionist rabbis, you refrain from expressing an opinion on the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. Why? Rav Lichtenstein responds, to express a position is a fine thing when you have a position, when things are clear, unequivocal, when you have the sense that you understand not just the intricacies of the political moves, but also what God would want. I didn't feel I had the tools or ability to express a position. And then comes one of the key lines. I don't have God's phone number the way some others seem to have. I was raised on the words of the Talmud about Bilam. He claimed having knowledge of the will of the Supreme. He couldn't even tell what his own beast wanted. And he claimed to know the will of the Supreme. Please, have a little humility. Not the fake kind, but the kind that rises from a person's understanding of who the Almighty is and who man is. A base, ignominious creature. I understand there were people for whom it was clear where the disengagement was leading and what God wanted. That's not how I grew up. Humility is not only an expression of religious awe, but also an expression of wisdom. And there's a second paragraph I'm going to read for you in a second, but I just want, again, I don't have God's phone number. You know, everyone else thinks they have. That is classic, you know, using theodicies to explain things. Oh, I, Rabbi X, no. The reason why this bad thing happened was due to this obvious thing that bothers me. That's claiming to have God's phone number. It's nonsense. And then the interviewer asks, you know, not one for subtlety. Are you insinuating criticism of the rabbis who opposed the disengagement? Rav Lichtenstein responds, I don't have to insinuate anything. It's no secret that there are large, self-confident segments of the public that have the sense that you can take a chapter of the book of Yeshayahu or Malachi and find a perfect match between the text and what's happening before our eyes. You can look into Tanakh. You know, this is not what he says. This is me. You know, the tonal shift hopefully indicated that. Again, theodicies are part and parcel of prophecies, are part woven into the fabric of Tanakh, the Gemara. But says Rav Lichtenstein, I'm not comfortable with that. I'm uncomfortable with that also from a religious perspective. It's true. Those of us within the religious Zionist camp have for years continued to march forward spiritually, economically, and socially with trust in God. Without that belief, it is doubtful that the religious Zionist stream would have come into existence to begin with. It began out of belief and hope, out of the feeling that mankind has a role to play in history. But then the final lines, but the difference between that and the sense that I can explain exactly why a bus explodes and kills 22 children is enormous. It is religious arrogance. It also smacks of people overstepping their limitations. The problem with theodicies ultimately is not their philosophical inelegance. It's actually, and again, this is where I come back to the distinction between the personal and philosophical problem. The personal problem of evil, and the truth is I kind of may have missed, overstepped this also myself, you know, a while ago. The personal problem of evil doesn't like changing evil to justice because it seems wrong. But from a technical level, it's actually a very simple answer. It does fall apart when you really start pushing people on mass atrocities and mass horrors. And, it, you know, if someone were to say the reason the Holocaust happened was because of religious Zionism, then you have to ask people, oh, but hold on a second. Then why this though? And all of a sudden, and okay, they'll have answers to a certain point. You know, once the angel of death gets going, he doesn't discriminate. We're familiar probably with these ideas if you've ever heard these kind of topics addressed. But ultimately, as elegant, technically speaking, as a solution it is, it ends up being a dissatisfying one if we cannot think of it as an acceptable resolution to why evil exists. And second, and more significantly, when it's used by the prophets themselves in Tanakh, when it's used by Chazal in the Gemara, fine. That, you know, that works. But when it's used by modern rabbis who are claiming to understand why God works the way he does, it smacks of arrogance. And it's disgraceful. You know, another example that just sprung to mind, people attach a lot of significance to, and I forget the details, and it wasn't something that appealed to me, so I didn't really preserve all of them. But when, you know, Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, we've spoken about both Notre Dame and Notre Dame. So there we go. We've covered both the university in America and the original cathedral in Paris. But when Notre Dame burnt down and people were like, oh, It's actually like the anniversary or something of the burning of the Talmud outside the cathedral. Cool. But like, really? That's how, like, Jews, that was a tragedy. That was persecution. That was destruction. Oh, we got them 1,000 years later when now it's just a cultural piece of their history and French is one of the least religious countries in the world. Whoa, the burning down of their cathedral really got them. Wow. Oh, amazing. Great job there. Like it doesn't work. These answers, the answers of theodicies when they don't come from a biblical or Talmudic source are at best designed to distract you for long enough that you'll stop answering the question and stop asking the question and move on. Or are, you know, just intentionally ignorant answers that often tell you more about the person offering the answer than the actual than any actual resolution to the question. And so I would say very firmly, if you couldn't guess, that the theodicy route in resolving the problem of evil, while it technically works, is a deeply unsatisfying one. Even if it is the answer most of us are, you know, told and given as the most obvious answer. And so what we're going to begin doing next week is looking at a few different responses that take a slightly more complicated way of answering this question. And to say from the outset, we're going to be critiquing all of the responses. We're going to be, you know, questioning how any of them ultimately hold up to, you know, the major questions. What we are already going to start seeing next week are some fascinating alternative resolutions to this challenge that don't assume evil is actually good. That at least assume, all the other answers assume, evil exists. They don't deny the existence of evil, which is ultimately the major crime of theodicies. To say evil does not exist, despite the fact that we visibly experience it, that we see it, that we know it happens. And therefore, some of these other answers will hopefully provide more satisfying resolutions to this deeply problematic theological question.